Are you a founder, co-founder, aspiring entrepreneur, or just someone who loves to hear about how companies are built? Then join us as we talk with founders and CEOs who have been there and done that. Welcome to the Founders Formula Podcast, sponsored by Hatchet Ventures. And now, your host, Chet Lovgren.
Welcome one, welcome all to the Founders Formula Podcast, the show that's designed to bring you the latest and greatest stories and insights from founders worldwide who have been there and done that. My guest today is a three-time founder, and prior to his entrepreneurship, was an experienced sales leader with a background in leading successful SaaS platforms and helping them increase their market share. He is currently the co-founder and CEO of Olive, an AI platform helping IT leaders evaluate technology decisions faster and helping them increase user adoption and speed to market. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to my guest, Chris Hurd. Chris, how's it going, man?
Pretty good. Couldn't complain about much.
Love it. And I'm glad we were able to make it work. I'm super excited to have you on the show today. I want to dig in a lot into the founding story of Olive and how you and your co-founder, Dan, started the company. But first, I know that the people are really interested to learn more about you, your story, and really your experience that's gotten you up to the point of founding Olive. So tell us a little bit about Chris. Give us the background story. Give us your synopsis.
Let's see if they're still interested after I tell it. I came from England, as some of you might tell. I was a pretty standard upbringing in Birmingham in the middle of England. Always had a bit of an entrepreneurial edge and was always trying to do something, tried to do a comic book. I actually tried to make a time machine when I was super young, and I got as far as building a brake. It was about as far as I came. But once I started getting into my career, I really fell into sales through a friend of mine that pushed me towards that. And I understood that there was more to sales than what it looked like from the outside. There's a lot of art to it, which, as someone who was pretty creative as a kid, I really enjoyed that aspect. But kind of mixing the creative side with the sales and business side, I think, is really why a lot of entrepreneurs succeed. And that was really, for me, it's a really good way to be creative. So you said three-time founder. I mean, my first two companies were very small, really paying the way through school and testing stuff out. I had one that was a catering company. I used to do cocktail bartending, juggling bottles. So we thought lots of people like that. So more people liked it than I thought at the time. So we did a lot of Indian weddings, a lot of parties, a lot of big garden parties in England with that. That was really fun. My wife and I actually did a leggings company. It was called leggings.ca. It was an e-commerce company. Really challenging. I mean, I think that all businesses are difficult. There were a lot of challenges with retail and e-commerce that people don't really understand. I don't think that many people appreciate just how difficult it is to build a brand and to get the margins right, to make profit from retail is really a challenge. So I say hats off to some of these successful retailers and all these people that are doing the e-commerce businesses. It's a tough one, but it's amazing and really rewarding. And yeah, so that was my entrepreneurial stuff. I moved to Canada in 2013. After being a bit sick of the UK, had a dream of living in California, found Vancouver in the Northwest, and actually was supposed to move to California a few years ago before I started Olive with my old company, and decided I wanted to live in the Northwest. So as a kid, I always dreamt of California. And then after going there a lot, there's something about the Pacific Northwest that I think is just really underappreciated. I love it. The rain actually helps sometimes. So we ended up staying here, getting into tech sales. And that was really where the idea for Olive came, was working with a lot of companies and how difficult it was for them to find the right decision, how easy it was for me to convince people sometimes to buy things that maybe wasn't the best fit. And that was really where that inspiration came. But yeah, I've always been knocking on the door of trying to build something and having that passion for entrepreneurship. This is, say, three-time founder, but I've tried a bunch. There's a lot of ideas that have kind of started and died immediately too. So I think I've always had that passion. And this was just the first time that the timing, both personally and professionally, and the timing for the market was right. And I think that's if we're going straight into lessons that I can teach from life, the first thing would be, if you just keep trying enough, you'll eventually get lucky.
Darts on the dartboard, right? Yeah, you got to get the practice in. That's something. So that's something I'm interested in hearing from you, kind of your perception, like these ideas that didn't pan out that you probably put some good work on and some good effort into ahead of time before you realize, hey, this just isn't going to pan out. How do you keep it going? Like, what is your mindset there when something you work really hard on doesn't pan out the way you wanted it to? And then, you know, you're back to the grind as a sales leader and haven't been able to go out on your own yet. How do you stay motivated through that? I'm sure there's a lot of aspiring entrepreneurs or even first-time entrepreneurs that are going through that right now. Can you shed some light on that?
Yeah, I think I look at it less than as going back to the grind and going back to school a little bit. You know, the one of the biggest ideas and what could have potentially been one of the most successful ideas that I had was actually with Dan, my current co-founder. We looked at delivery services in Vancouver. How can we get the bike couriers to start delivering things across Vancouver? Food, your laundry, whatever. Think of Postmates or early Postmates. And so we started working on this. And now that's DoorDash, Uber Eats, right? If we'd have had the business sense then, we could have been there. But we didn't. It was just the wrong timing personally. The idea and the market timing was right, but our timing wasn't right. We didn't know operations. We didn't understand how to run a business. There was lots of things. We were just really immature in our professional careers. So I think that going back and then really honing a skill, sales was my skill, but also when you're doing enterprise sales, you get to learn a lot about businesses too. Just maturing in the professional world was just as important. I don't know if Olive is as big an idea as DoorDash would have been then, but we're much better positioned to execute on it. So I think it's less about staying motivated and just looking at it and saying, okay, why didn't that one work? What do I need to improve on? And then taking that and going and helping another company be successful while you're still learning that, while you're learning those skills. I think that's really the key. It's less about, you know, having to stay motivated and more about using each one of those failures as a learning lesson, taking that and then trying to learn something from it.
Yeah, that's a real growth mindset. I love that. Let's talk about Olive. I think that's interesting. You brought up a good point. Like, you know, I had all this experience of not only being sold products, but also selling products and just seeing some of them not adopt properly, seeing companies not get the speed to value that they're looking for. I'm sure that's kind of the itch that you wanted to scratch or the problem that you saw that you needed to solve for. But talk about that sales experience that led into that founding of Olive and then how you and your co-founder founded Olive. And more importantly, dig in a little bit to what Olive exactly is, how it helps, and what it does that we might not have covered in the intro.
Sure, that might be a good place to start. So essentially, Olive helps companies make better technology decisions faster. The current process of evaluating a decision for anything, HCM suites, ERPs, chatbots, whatever it is, it's very manual. It's spreadsheets, it's talking to your stakeholders, interviewing them, taking notes, Googling around for potential vendors, inviting them for demos, taking notes, filling in spreadsheets, RFP responses. There's all sorts of layers of complexity to making these decisions that there isn't really much software to help enable. On the flip side, if you're selling those products, you have everything. Outreach, you know, I'm calling names out here, I probably shouldn't. It's sales automation software, CRMs, etc. There's a lot of technology you can use as a salesperson to take control of that sales cycle, and there's very little on the buying side. So we really help companies to collaborate more deeply with their internal stakeholders and with vendors to really have a thorough due diligence throughout these selection processes, but make it faster for them, allow them to do that in an agile manner instead of a waterfall manner. So instead of that decision taking 6 months, the decision can take 2 months, implementation can take 2 months, and now you're off to the races in 4 in the usual time it would have taken just to get to a yes, with the additional benefit of having more due diligence leading to a better user adoption. And just a general better experience with the vendor for both sides. So that's what Olive does. As with most businesses, it came from a pain that we were experiencing. And I always wanted to work with the ocean as a kid. You know, that was my passion. And it still is. The ocean is still my passion. And, you know, I studied the ocean That was what I always expected. I was going to be a marine biologist on an island counting fish somewhere or something. Was my career goals. But once I got into sales and I started, like I mentioned, I loved the art of it. I loved the kind of creative element of it. But I did always find that part of the job was biasing people. And usually, you know, if you're in a good company, you're working with a great product, you're biasing people to understand something that's going to help them. But sometimes you're biasing people away from what could potentially be the best product for them because you only have one option to sell. And so the ability to do that was a little frustrating and felt a bit gross, to be honest with you. There were some relationships that I built with IT leaders and buyers that fell apart once they bought and implemented something I told them, which felt terrible because I wasn't trying out to do any wrong to them. I was, you know, hitting my quota and doing my job, and I thought the product would help them. But you could see, you know, it didn't really sit very well with us. And so because of that, we wanted to look at, okay, how do we get the bias out of these decision processes? And usually transparency helps with bias. If you can actually see all the options, if you can get clear apples to apples comparisons, you can make an objective decision on what you want to purchase. That's really difficult to do today. And so hence why talented sales teams and salespeople are able to bias people's decisions. And that's across the board. It's not a bad thing. You know, sometimes you're biasing them to the right decision. Sometimes it's not perfect for them. But that was really the bias was what we wanted to get out. When we started digging into the process that people were going through on these decisions, there was more than just bias as a challenge. The efficiency of this process was crazy. If buyers were quoted the way salespeople were quoted and measured on their time and their activities, they would all be fired because there's just so much wasted time. It's crazy. So we thought, okay, well, how do we, now we've got a gap. Now we've got a product, right? Taking bias out is so ethereal, but making people more efficient is typically what software can help with. And that's where we saw this sort of green field where we can take what's already a very structured process and put it into software. And I think the easiest analogy for people that are sales-minded, which a lot of people listening to this, I'm sure, are, is before CRMs, we were selling on spreadsheets and Rolodexes and stuff. But there was a sales process. The CRMs didn't invent a sales process and then educate people on how to run a sales process within their technology. They took a process that was already well fleshed out, just delivered manually, and put it into software. And the buying process is pretty similar, whether you're Deloitte or Accenture servicing a customer, or you're a multinational manufacturing company, or you're a local restaurant chain. The process is still, I have a business problem. There's multiple people in my organization that care about it. I need to understand the use cases, understand the requirements of any solution, find solutions, compare them against that, make decision. It doesn't really change. It's very similar, just like a sales process. And so that's where we really found, that's when the rubber hit the road, to use a pretty standard term. And we, okay, now we've got something. And that was really the start of it.
What's interesting to me is I know you have a pretty extensive sales background. So obviously taking something to market, creating unit economics, all the great stuff you probably do from a sales perspective when you're taking something to market, you probably have that on lock. Interested to hear kind of like what's Dan's background, especially since this is a technical product. Did he kind of then handle more of the technical side of founding the company, or how did you two, when you started this idea up, especially when it comes to AI, right? How did you get that whole thing set up from a technical perspective, and how challenging was that?
So, I mean, first off, I definitely don't have any of that on lock. I don't know if many people have it on lock, and I'm definitely still learning and learning and learning. And it's interesting that listening to these kind of conversations has been really useful throughout the growth, and it continues to be. There's always somebody that is 3 months, 6 months, or 3 years ahead of you, and your stage, and you're constantly learning. So I definitely don't have that stuff unlocked. Just want to clarify that. But what I definitely don't have unlocked is technical stuff. So that's beyond, I'm not even approaching the lock on those. So yeah, Dan was a computer science grad, engineer was his first career, went into sales engineering. So he kind of transitioned away from engineering and was by far the most technical sales engineer I ever worked with. Actually, it was the best sales engineer, salesperson relationship I ever had. I worked with a number of sales engineers after that. If any of them are listening, I apologize. You also were great in your own ways, but Dan was awesome. And he's always wanted to be an engineer. Sales engineer just kind of fell on his lap because he's a good communicator. And so, yeah, when it started, it was Dan and myself. We did outsource to a local company in Vancouver. I can give a shout out, can't I? TTT Studios in Vancouver. They're an amazing agency, and they really helped us with the first MVP. So Dan worked alongside their engineers to get the first MVP out. And then, yeah, it was really Dan building the technical side of things. But at that stage, when there's two, you know, you're kind of both doing everything. I was doing a lot of product, right? A lot of the design work, even though I didn't really know what I was doing. We were both collaborating on that. You're just doing everything. I think that as we've grown, there's just a few less hats. You're still wearing lots of hats, but at the start, you're just doing a tiny little bit of everything. So what was amazing is we didn't have a specific technical founder and a specific sales founder. We were both a little bit of both. Like, I was a technical lead for the leggings company I was talking about, right? Very basic, but still have a little bit of technical knowledge. Dan has a bit of sales knowledge. And so that was what worked really well, I think, was a Venn diagram of talents, as opposed to just two complete silos of talent. And that really, really helped us in the beginning. And then obviously, as we built up, Dan brought on other people in that team. Dan's role sort of shifted and moved around. We get to this point now where we have very defined leaders in different areas. It's unbelievable to see how much better not only having someone that's experienced is, but having someone dedicated to something is. It's unbelievable. Like, just if you're trying to do 50% of your time on something, someone doing 100% of the time is five times better at least. So that's been really, really interesting. We did a great job, don't get me wrong, of grinding it out. But yeah, just shows you when you start to focus on something, focus is incredibly powerful.
So I'm a little hated with sales leaders because I absolutely am disgusted when they try to have account executives do prospecting, because it's like, that's what you're paying SDRs to do. Right. Like that's like $30 an hour work, and you're paying AEs like $50 an hour, basically. Have them go close deals. If you don't have enough deals to close, and that's why you want them to prospect, then find ways to enable the SDR team or get a better SDR leader, like plain and simple, right? Like, if I'm not hiring an account executive paying 150, 175 OTE to go make cold calls, maybe open lost ops. But yeah, this, I've seen a lot of orgs right now giving their salespeople on the account executive side, like self-generated opportunity quotas. And I'm like, that's total horse crock. Like, that doesn't make any sense. Specialization is key.
It doesn't work. Mm-hmm. We did that to start with, right? We had one salesperson, so.
Exactly. A little different, yeah.
You kind of have to. Right? Yeah. And it's amazing the difference now that we have SDRs, dedicated SDRs, in the close rates, in the size of deals. But just all of those sales metrics that you care about went through the roof once we split those teams up. You have to be able to. I mean, at the start, the CEO is the BDR and the sales account exec and everything, right? But that specialization has been amazing. From the sales specifically has been a really clear benefit.
And I'd like to ask you, now that it feels like there's a new SaaS product we hear about every week, right? Somebody's raising money, there's a new product, somebody's announcing a new position at a stealth startup, or they're going to market, whatever. Do you feel, and in what way do you feel, that has played a part in any accelerated growth during COVID? Because now there are so many new tech products out there. How do you feel that's impacting your business? Because now you're not just evaluating one sales engagement tool that is an industry standard. Now you have like 10 new options. How is that playing a part in what you all do?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, COVID, I think, was a different thing, where that was a lot of companies that were behind the eight ball on unified communications and chat and just generally remote communication with the team. So I think that there was just a lot of new evaluations and new technology that people needed to look at during COVID that they'd not really bothered with before. Restaurants is a perfect example. I wrote a piece recently about how that tiny recession, that real quick COVID recession that we had, impacted restaurants so much. Like that was just that for them, that was the biggest change, you know, almost ever for them, biggest impact since Prohibition maybe. And what they did as a very technology averse industry, restaurants are all about money in the till. That's all they care about. They just want to get money in the till. Tech is so far behind. They went wild on tech. Everybody had to innovate to stay alive because you wouldn't even have a dollar in the till if you didn't invest in tech. So they didn't have an option. And because the hand was forced, they ended up buying a lot of stuff. But what's happened is those restaurant chains now have not dropped that tech. They still use it, right? QR codes, the online ordering, all of these different technologies, restaurants are still sticking with it because they've seen an improvement in the business, but it took a massive event for them for that to happen. And so to kind of bring it back to your point, I think COVID was one unique instance, but the constant growth of tech, because it's exponential, regardless of whether there's a COVID or not, because tech breeds tech. Once you have a tech solution that you need, now I live on that. Well, now I also need these other things to talk to this thing. So now I need to get another thing that talks to this. And now maybe I need a layer in between those things that can talk to those two things. It just constantly grows. And so there has been an explosion of tech because there's been an explosion of exposure to solvable business problems. I think that's really what's happened. How that's impacted our business, of course, it's great that there's more options. It's also great that I think there's a lot more adoption of technology during more tumultuous economic times as well, where a lot of companies see automation and streamlining as key. And so maybe in the past, people thought technology is so expensive, I have to host it. It's really difficult to manage, so I won't invest. And so I'm going to cut my software budgets. Now they're seeing actually software can make my people way more productive. So it can actually, these companies that are pausing on hiring, they're not slowing down. They're actually using technology to get more and more productivity out of their existing team, right? So I think that, yeah, it's good for us. I think it's really good for the startups that there are people like us that exist, because it can, when you get these explosions, people can just go to the top right of the magic quadrant, right? Or the top right of the online review site and just choose those. But I think now that people are aware of companies like ours that can help you evaluate tech with a less biased lens and without having to limit yourself to two or three options, now people are looking at more unique niche players. And that's exactly what people need. You know, the startups need the early adopters. The early adopters need the startups. And once you solve a small problem for a small group in a company, you'll eventually build and build and build to solve a lot of problems for that company. So yeah, for me, I mean, tech explosion, and everybody complains about massive amounts of tech and tech sprawl, but if it's solving business problems, as long as it's solving business problems, I think there's nothing negative about it.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. And totally agree. Like the review sites, without naming names, I remember when somebody prospected me when I was an SDR leader 3 years ago at a tech company, and they're like, would you be interested in this and that? And I was like, wait, they have salespeople at these sites? And then my VP of sales was like, oh yeah, brother, like they're hawking leads for like $500 a piece. They're like, I'm like, well, if I'm going to get an unbiased opinion, like I would want to have an unbiased opinion, not just whoever is first to the bull with a cash offer for my business, you know? So I think that's really cool that you built that, because it kind of adds that extra layer of transparency that needs to be there. Obviously the review sites are great to give someone a starting point and understand, well, this software might be too expensive for my budget right now, but what are some potential competitors? And then being able to use a software like yours to further evaluate things, I think is awesome and holds that world of evaluation accountable. So that's really cool. I want to talk in closing a little bit about the funding side of your business, because I know you've raised multiple rounds. You had a pre-seed round, I believe we were talking in 2020, and then end of last year to the beginning of this year, you raised your seed round. Curious to hear from you, which one was the hardest? Did you find the first round was hard? Did you find the most recent round was a little bit harder? And what kind of tips or insights would you share with someone who's going through their first round of funding right now as they're working through that process?
They're all hard in different ways. I don't think there's one harder than the other. One piece of advice I'd give to anybody who's founding a company right now, just expect everything to be hard always for the entire duration. But as long as you're feeding off it and you're up for the challenge, it's awesome. But expect everything to be difficult. Before the seed round, we had some sort of friends and family, sort of angel stuff. It was probably the hardest, to be honest with you. I think the one piece of advice I could say to founders who are just starting out on raising and they're starting to speak to people for the very first time is take everything with a pinch of salt, but particularly when you're in that really, really early speaking to angels conversation. Angels are great. They are the starters for businesses, but some angels can have ideas about your business that are way beyond where you are, and they can request information that Series B investors sometimes don't even ask for, where you just won't have certain numbers. Like CAC to LTV, you're not going to have it. You don't have any customers. There's certain things that you just won't know, and it's okay to say that. And that's a good way to identify if that person's going to be part of your cap table forever. Is that someone you want around? And if the money looks great right now, but those very, very early investors, I think you always have to be very selective with who you bring on. But don't dismiss it because it's a small check, thinking you're not going to have to deal with issues. Those can happen later on, regardless. But you've got to make sure that person you're bringing on is aligned with your business, knows you, understands you, and that you can spend a long time with them. So I think number one is just take everything with a grain of salt. Always take all information on. Don't deny any advice. Always take all advice, but then filter it out, right, and try and find the patterns. The first round was difficult. We came out of Techstars. It was COVID. No one really knew what the world was going to look like. I was very amateur, of course. So it was really difficult, but we had some great advisors. We had some great mentors and surrounded myself with as many people that could help guide me on that path as I could. And it was great. The last round, from a funding perspective and finding the partner kind of fell on our lap in a way, because there was a recommendation and introduction from our existing investors, which, again, superpower of having a network. It's unbelievable. It just adds such a superpower to you as a founder. Having other people to introduce you is number one. It's amazing. So that helped. And the fact that our lead from the last round was in Chicago, which is the Midwest, has a special place in not only my heart, but the way we operate, we kind of operate our business with a Midwest mentality, which is, you know, work hard, but have fun. Don't take yourself too seriously is very much our vibe. And it really, really gelled with us. Plus, they've made some really good picks previously. Our partner is amazing. And so that part was relatively straightforward. Obviously, it was a massive grant. I had to speak to 1,000 people. I'm making it sound a lot easier than it was. I had to speak to 1,000 people to find this. The hardest thing I think that I would, the one thing that really surprised me was the legal stuff. When you do safes and convertible notes and stuff, you're pushing off a lot of legal stuff that I didn't think about. And that's where it's the same thing. Like if you've got an ache in your knee, go to the doctor. Don't just, I'll wait. And then all of a sudden you can't walk. I'm glad we did it when we did, because there was a lot of cleanup, a lot of legal stuff that had to be involved in the process. It was expensive. It was long. It took a while. I got COVID in the middle of it. So I was on the couch, like shivering on the phone to my lawyer while trying to get this deal closed. So that would be one thing that I would suggest people keep their eye on, is just be aware. Not only is every round going to take longer than you think, but if it's your first ever round, you're going to have to listen to a lot of BS, I guess, for want of a better word, to filter out. And then if it's your first non-safe convertible round, just be ready to step up the level of seriousness. The company gets very real at that point, and there's some, you know, you have to get lawyers involved. It has to get a lot more strict. There's a lot less shooting from the hip when it comes to that. So It depends what stage it is. I mean, seeds can be done on safes and convertible notes. I'm sure A's probably can at this point, but you know, once you're doing that price round, it's tough.
Sounds like I'm not envious, first of all. Sounds like a pretty extensive process, but I love that you were able to share that. And you know, congrats on raising that seed round earlier this year. So that brings us to time here. I definitely want to give you an opportunity if people are interested in connecting with you, connecting with Dan, connecting with Olive as a whole. What's the best way to get in touch with you? And I'm sure we'll put some information in the show notes for everybody, but where can people reach out with you and connect with you?
Yeah, the easiest thing, I mean, if you're interested in Olive, the easiest thing is the website, www.olive.app. You can also email info@olive.app if you want to get connected with Olive. If you wanted to reach out to me, again, it's pretty simple. Email's usually the best way to reach me. It's Chris, Chris, at olive.app. I'm not Mr. Social. So I do have a LinkedIn. If there's any social type of reach out, LinkedIn's the only place I'll check. There's a Twitter account for me, but it's mostly posted by the team, and I tend to check it very rarely, simply because I don't know. My thoughts on social media will be another conversation chat.
I love it. If you're interested in engaging with the Founders Formula podcast further, you can connect with us on social and on all of our platforms with the link in the show notes. We are live on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and full long form video content is now available on YouTube. Chris, thank you so much for carving out some time for us on this beautiful day. Appreciate your time, and we'll catch everybody on the next one. Thanks, Chris.
Thanks, Jeff.